I'm overwhelmed by the expertise of my fellow speakers. I have no expertise at all. I look at policies. And like all healthcare, policy becomes important because it has to be funded, it has to be applied, it has to be researched. And while the details can overwhelm one, in real life, if the structure isn't there, if the money isn't there, if the research protocols aren't there, it's sort of like whack-a-mole. It's sort of hit or miss in the end. So when I was asked to talk about this, big mistake on their part, I thought, okay, let's do this in terms of what I do best, supposing I do anything best, and that's to talk in terms of policy. So let me do this as background. Healthcare, as you all know, is delivered in the Hippocratic tradition. The primary determinant is to act in the best interest of the patient. That's the old Hippocratic Oath, that's the new Hippocratic Oath, that's the mandate that physicians really have when they deal with patients. And that historically really didn't do much. Hippocrates was a bit of a weirdo. He really was. Anybody who tells you never to do surgery as a contemporary physician would really have serious problems. And, well, never mind, I won't go on. So really, scientific Hippocratic medicine got off the ground in the Islamic world with Ibn Sina in the 10th, 11th century Common Era, who really invented scientific medicine and who said, if you're going to do the best for the patient, you've got to do experiments. You've got to do controlled research. And he started that, and that was then picked up later in the West. What we call Western medicine, I always put that in, is not Western at all. It's ultimately Islamic, comes from the Arabic world. They invented that stuff. But anyway, so scientific medicine, experimental medicine, then really took off. And the interesting thing is that it depended on statistics. That is to say, you did controlled experiments, and you looked at the data, and on the basis of those data, applied that to your individual patients. The problem being, of course, that a patient is not a statistic. As you have heard from the previous speakers, patients are very individual entities. Even when they share the same genes, epigenetic changes lead to different situations. I know that on a personal level, I have a pair of clones at home. They're called identical twins. They're clones of each other. And even though they have essentially the same genes, they are not the same, not even medically. So essentially, this scientific medicine was a hit or a miss affair, really, for the best interest of the patient. So personalized medicine that comes close to fulfilling this Hippocratic ideal by taking into account not only the genetic profile, but also all the other parameters of the individual patient. But in all of life, there's no such things as a free lunch. Second law of thermodynamics applies to real life. For everything in life, you pay. So you have old problems coming up, but they acquire a new twist. Why are they acquiring a new twist? Because, of course, the techniques that have been developed, what has been done, is now in a new context. And in every new context, the issues that arise take a different form. And the issues that arise start with privacy and confidentiality. I'll have more to say about that later. Access and funding, I mentioned that already. That's very important. And then, of course, how do you develop all of this you have the traditional problem of orphan diseases without personalized medicine, when pharma, and everybody loves to throw a rock at pharma, but as I keep telling my medical students, make sure you got the right rock and throw it at the right party. Because a lot of what pharma are accused of really isn't pharma's fault, but that's another story. Okay, so how are you going to fund all of this research? Because what you, in healthcare, what you give to one in terms of funding, you take away from the other. So if this has to be funded for, where's the money going to come from? And if pharma can't make a profit on it, it has, believe it or not, an ethical duty not to do it. Why? Very simple. Pharmaceutical companies do not have an obligation towards patients. They have an obligation towards their stockholders. That's straightforward business ethics. And not to make the money on the basis of their investment is to be unethical towards their stockholders. So if they can't make money on this, they're jolly well not going to fund it. They shouldn't. So funding becomes an issue. And also, of course, there's a problem of informed consent. The problem of informed consent is any time you intervene with a patient, any of the patients that I've mentioned or I've been referred to before, they must give informed consent. Otherwise, it's criminally assault and battery. But to get proper, and there's even a Supreme Court case on that. My favorite case, Reibel versus Hughes, 1980. So how do you inform the patient? How do you give consent, making sure the patient is not pressured, doesn't feel pressured? Issues, old issues, but they acquire new twists. Privacy and confidentiality. As soon as you start using genomic information, and notice I don't have any sexy pictures, as soon as you use information, then you know that in genetic information is shared. Not perhaps point mutations, but the whole genetic information in general is shared. And then you acquire the issue of control over that genetic information. Who owns that gene? You don't think that's important? Oh, heck. There's a single case from California where the company made over $1.5 billion in 15 years simply dealing with that particular gene because they patented it. So this is not small change. It's an issue that has to be addressed once you start making policy. There's also the issue of duty to warn. We've heard that certain mutations can get passed on. Hemophilia was one of them, right? Do you have a duty to warn? Very interesting question. In ethics or in law, as soon as you start doing personalized medicine, the precision with which you know that allows you to look at that much more closely. So the question that arises, do we really need a new paradigm for what it is to be a patient, a person? The patient as individual here and now who presents to the individual physician, to the geneticist, to the cancer specialist, and so on, as well as the patient as embedded in a whole group of individuals who also share stuff with that patient. We've started to address that issue in an overall context. We haven't dealt with that yet completely, and certainly it's something that stands in the wings with genomically based personalized medicine. It's got to be handled, and we have nothing on that at the present time. Then the data banks. The data that were referred to by the previous speakers all want to be stored. They should be stored, otherwise they're useless. In data banks. But that raises a very interesting question, not only with respect to security, confidentiality, privacy, and accessibility, but in particular, accessibility. Would it be ethically appropriate to say that individual physicians, faced with a particular patient should have access to the relevant data banks to be able to use the data that have been identified on the basis of personalized genomic information. Why is that? Well, it's a no-brainer, right? You would want to say, yes, indeed. But that's a little bit of a problem. Remember, that's I said all of these problems were there before. They acquire a new twist. Why? Well, it may or may not surprise you to know that pharmacists have access to PharmaNet. All pharmacists have access to PharmaNet, which is the data bank that deals with what medications you have been prescribed. And that's why pharmacists catch physicians' errors more frequently than physicians themselves. They also have other uses. But physicians don't have access to PharmaNet. So they cannot act appropriately with respect to a patient, with respect to medication, because there's no policy of access to data banks that deal with the health profile of individual patients. That's an issue that has to be addressed. Is there a qualification that a physician must have in order to practice this? Is there a qualification that hospitals must have in order to be able to have access to these data? Do you do this nationally, internationally? And of course, there is the issue of money. Look, healthcare is expensive. And I don't care whether you want to go private or public. There's never enough money to go around. Why? Well, let me give you an example even from private healthcare. Next time you buy healthcare insurance when you travel, look at what's excluded. And look at how many times you can get what you want. Why? Because it costs the company money. And if you use it too much, they lose money. So how do you do that? So they, whether you're private or public, you have a funding problem. And a public healthcare system also has funding problem. For example, if you fund the genomic healthcare center, can you still fund a neonatal ICU? Well, yeah, you can. But what else are you going to cut? As I said before, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And it has nothing to do with private or public healthcare. You can only do certain things. So funding in terms of application. Development, who's going to develop all of this? Currently, a lot of it is developed by the BC Ministry of Health and other individuals, in part also by private funding. But there's no integrated policy that allows us to develop this in a way which doesn't deteriorate all of the healthcare. So we have to make choices. And very few individuals so far have looked at the choices. As I said before, personalized medicine in its broader context comes with a price. And for everything in life, you pay. Then, of course, you also require something else. You require guidelines. It's all very well and good to say that we will identify a particular gene and we will deal with it in a certain way. But that can't be one-off each time. In other words, you have to have guidelines on how to do this, not perhaps with this particular condition, but how to deal with patients in general, practice guidelines. How do you develop those? Again, we have nothing in place right now. And simply saying that, well, we will do this on each individual case is simply to sidestep the issue, because it ties to the issue of responsibility and informed consent. If the patient says to the physician, yes, I'm unique. Yes, you've tried this in other cases. But what is the general protocol? If the patient doesn't get an answer, the patient can't give informed consent. Because informed consent, as defined ethically as well as legally, and that's Reibel versus Hughes, Supreme Court of Canada, 1980s, to tell unasked what the objective reasonable person in the patient's position would want to know before accepting or rejecting, and to disclose that at a level the patient can understand. That has to be translated to personalized medicine. This may all sound airy-fairy, but in the end, there's an outfit that looks after physicians and patients, and these are called lawyers. And they're going to be very happy if this is not handled appropriately. And the overarching consideration, remember, I had nothing to say because I really know nothing about this area. I look at policy. The overarching consideration in all of this is that one should not be trapped by the technological imperative. The technological imperative is a can-do, must-do mentality. Personalized medicine, as it has been described and as it is being developed, involves the transfer of technology, of science, of knowledge, from other domains to this particular context. But every context is different. And simply to transfer the technology and to expect the individuals who deal with it to solve the problem is not really to solve the problem. It's to ignore the issue of whether this is done appropriately in the first place. Because technical solutions aren't ethical solutions. They aren't even legal solutions. So why have I said all of this? Because this personalized medicine, as it has been described, is wonderful. It promises to do what Hippocrates wanted to do in the best interest of the patient. But the best interest of the patient has to involve all of these parameters. And unless a proper protocol is put into place, this is sort of like topsy, just grows. Thank you.